And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. It seems sometimes when talking about various prejudices in the world, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. There are many prejudices in America of all kinds. We're aware of many of them. Racism is often discussed. It is real. It is probably the most severe of all prejudices in America. Not that we need to compare. They are all severe. We certainly have anti-gay prejudice. We talked about this in the last hour. And it's perhaps the greatest may be prejudice against atheists, in the sense that people say that a majority of Americans say they will never vote for an atheist for president. But one of the oldest prejudices on earth, I think, is increasing now. And what's interesting to me is it's increasing on the right and the left. On the right, we have supporters of Ron Paul, not realizing, I think, his own anti-Semitic past. Ron Paul, most people support him. I like what he says about Iraq. I certainly like what he says, as a libertarian. I don't agree with a lot of his policies, but most are not aware that he was with the black helicopter crowd, with a number of the conspiracy theorists who blame all of America's troubles on the Federal Reserve, and somehow they put the Federal Reserve in connection with Jews, and therefore the right wing complains about Jews. I see the same thing on the left wing side. It's perfectly fair, perfectly fine to criticize Paul Wolfowitz and Daniel Pearl. I do so myself often. But why is it important for some to mention that they're Jewish? After all, there are a lot of neoconservatives. Dick Cheney isn't Jewish and Don Rumsfeld isn't Jewish. And it's perfectly fair to criticize these men for their policies. But when people are pointing out that they are Jewish, what are they trying to say? I find the same thing happens with what some call the Jewish lobby. Really what they mean is the pro-Israel lobby, which those of us who know that it's not just Jews that support the State of Israel. It's not even just Christian fundamentalists. You find the support actually throughout much of American society as a democracy fighting to stay in a very tough neighborhood against a number of countries that want war against it. Here you have right now, of course, Gaza, run by Hamas, lobbing missiles into Israel. And they are on the brink of war. And they're lobbing some 40 missiles a day. In fact, they just killed a six-month-year-old child. And Israel is wondering how to respond. And what's interesting is when Israel has shut off, for example, fuel deliveries into Gaza, Europe, the United Nations, complains. How dare you shut off fuel to a country that's making war with you? And the question in my mind is, would they make the same complaint against a non-Jewish state? I don't know that I have the answers to this. I do think that if America were getting 40 missiles a day from Mexico and we decided to stop trading with Mexico, I can't see anyone complaining. In fact, the only complaint I think would be that America was being far too weak. Can you imagine a Democratic president? Mexicans are lobbing 40 missiles a day, killing people in Texas, and our response is only to cut off fuel supplies? The question is, what is it about Israel that crosses the line into anti-Semitism? Now, it's certainly not anti-Semitic to criticize Israeli policy. That's something that lots of people do, that Israelis do, that non-Jews do, that Friends of Israel do. It's perfectly fair to criticize the action of the Israeli government. But I would argue that when you say that Israel shouldn't exist, when you say that the Jews that are there, all of whom are either native to the region or were expelled from Arab countries into the land or expelled from European countries into the land, when you say that they shouldn't exist, that Israel shouldn't be a Jewish state, where should they go? Maybe to some gas chambers? Where are they supposed to go if Israel ceases to exist? And that's why I think you have mainstream policy on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, strongly supporting Israel's right to exist, condemning some actions of Israel. But I would wonder when it crosses over into anti-Semitism. And related to this is a discussion I had with the founder of the Dreams End blog. His name is Ty Brown, and he's been researching a proposal by the Methodist Church to divest from companies doing business with Israel. Now, you might think, well, that's just anti-Israel. That's not anti-Semitic. Ty Brown comes to a different conclusion. Ty, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be here.
Now, on your blog, on the Dreams End blog, you talk about what the Methodist Church is doing. Before I get to that, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and what the Dreams End blog is about?
Well, I got started. I had another blog at one point that had the same name, and I moved it, and I've moved it again, but now you can find it at dreamsendweb.com. And I started looking into, since this current Iraq war, I was concerned about why the focus on neocons and why this sort of rhetoric about Israel is the cause of it, the U.S. is doing Israel's bidding. That was one of the things I was looking into. Anti-Semitism aside, it's also just not good tactics to be going after the wrong enemy when you're trying to stop a war.
And to be clear, you opposed, Ty, just to be clear, you opposed the Iraq war, you opposed neoconservatives. I just want to get, you know, what your views are on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I oppose the Iraq war. This is why I'm saying it's tactically, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go after the wrong enemy if you're trying to stop a war. And the war was not at the behest of Israel, was my conclusion. Who are these people who are saying that it is? And to me, it was important not just where they're pointing towards, but also what are they pointing away from? What are they not wanting us to look at? And I don't know if we'll have time, but I was just came across some articles about new FBI information about the 911 timeline that really seemed to suggest the hijackers had much closer Saudi ties and were under more direct Saudi control than even we had been led to believe.
Interesting. So, we just talked about that the last hour, in fact, how we some of our U.S. agents had dressed up in the robes of the Saudi government and without torture, but indeed with trickery, had talked to them. And they said, well, the Saudi government knew all about 9/11, and that's gotten very little press. So it's interesting that you bring this up as well.
Well, it's a recent article, which I'll hopefully have linked on my blog. It's in my discussion forum at the moment, but it was the FBI just has a timeline that the 911 Commission chose not to use when tracing a particular couple of hijackers and their movements. One of whom, by the way, had extensive travel plans after the hijacking, had a couple other flights reserved, but they found the FBI contradicted the 911 Commission by finding that these two guys didn't just hang around L.A. for 2 weeks and then run into this Saudi defense contractor employee. In fact, that's where they went immediately. He had a lot of phone traffic with the Saudi government before they came to him. So it makes it very clear that there was a relationship there. Anyway, that's the sort of thing. Why aren't we looking at that? And particularly, why aren't why isn't my side looking at that, the left? And why are so many people on the left talking about how it's Israel that's causing the U.S. to do these things, including someone we've talked about before, a former CIA agent named Ray McGovern? Why is he putting out this idea that Israel is the cause of it? Well, I think there's a lot more prosaic stuff going on. It's about oil. It's about business relationships with the Saudis and the Bushes. And all this sort of stuff is pretty easy to demonstrate, and yet nobody's really talking about it. And then there's other stuff that's a little more bizarre. Just I'll wrap this up, but I want people to be prepared, because on my blog I have some weird sections like Nazis from Outer Space. And that's about the sort of strange fascist and even sometimes direct Nazi connections behind odd sorts of New Age belief systems, UFO and contactee cults, and a lot of the current New Age has some very sort of questionable origins. And so I was looking into that sort of thing, and then there's a lot of stuff on there that gets into taking a closer look at some of the weirder New Age stuff from this slightly different perspective. Well, this is something strange going on here.
Let me be frank with you. Yeah. The stuff you say is so, it seems outlandish. I mean, let's be fair. How is it that someone is to know that you are giving us the facts here? And I mean, Nazis in outer space? So I mean, it seems too weird to be believed.
Let me give you an easy example. In the 50s was when some of the famous, what they called contactees, emerged. These were people who were claiming to be receiving communication from aliens, okay? And as you know, that is a big sort of pop culture theme now. So it's really not insignificant. Where did this whole thing start? Exactly what it means, I can't tell you. There's a guy named George Adamski who was a very famous contactee back in the 50s, and he was directly connected to another guy who was also known in the sort of alien contactee world named William Paley, and something called the Nazi Silver Shirts. They were a U.S. Sort of version of the Nazi brown shirts. This is all very well documented. There's nothing controversial about this. Everybody knows who studied Adamski that he had these ties, and everybody knows that that's real. And it turns out that a lot of the things the aliens were saying, they happened to be Nordic looking. They were blonde, for example, and blue eyed, really dovetails in sort of nicely, not directly with Nazi politics, but sort of the Nazi belief mythos, sort of mythology that underlay a lot of the Nazi policies. So that stuff's pretty well known, and I was just tracking it and kind of seeing how it influenced all the way up to the current sort of New Age movement. It's not as weird as it sounds. It's pretty well documented. And
now, you're not arguing that all New Agers are Nazis.
Oh, not at all. And the reason I got into
what is the connection? To be clear, what is the connection?
Yeah, it really has to do with certain sorts of, I guess, belief systems that are part of the New Age, but not all of the New Age. Some of it is directly, even to this day, some of the stuff that gets channeled from sometimes aliens, sometimes from other entities, some of it's directly anti-Semitic. For whatever reason, the people who channel these aliens, the aliens always have a special message about Jews. It's fairly frequent. And that stuff continues. There's groups now that still have this sort of message. But then it also kind of dovetails into some of this weird conspiracy culture. And by the way, I'm not anti-conspiracist. I believe in conspiracies. Some that we know about, like Iran-Contra, was certainly a conspiracy. Some that are not accepted, although there was new evidence that was just released about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, some acoustic stuff that was done. It said, no way, there was only one gunman. So I do believe that stuff is real, and I do believe that people in power do conspire together to do bad things. So I'm not condemning conspiracy theory the way we condemn anyone who has an alternate view. But some of the stuff that, again, distracts us from the truth and sort of points towards, maybe they don't say Jews, maybe they say, like David Icke, a guy in England who's fairly well known, that it's reptilian aliens, but he sort of morphed from reptilians. Originally, he was actually talking about protocols of the Elders of Zion, the famous hoax that had the, you know, Jewish world conspiracy. He used that as sort of a working document, and he finally decided, no, it's not Jews, it's these reptilian aliens.
Do you find, Ty, that I'm just curious. Do you find that the far right and the far left come together on this issue of anti-Semitism?
Not in the same way. I think the historical roots of the left and anti-Semitism don't come from the same perspective. And I think there's a lot of people on the left who even hold views, and we need to be clear about this, who hold views that I would find cross the line in anti-Semitism. They themselves do not consider themselves anti-Semitic. They do not themselves think of themselves as hating Jewish people. That's not really what their analysis comes from, but it ends up having a lot of times the same effect. And that's important. It's anti-Semitism is in terms of discrimination and that sort of thing. And then there's what I like to call Jewish control theory, Jewish power theories. And there really are people out there who have bought into this sort of stuff who, really, if you're Jewish and you're talking to them directly, they wouldn't have a problem. So we should be clear about that. Not everyone who is adopting these beliefs that I'm concerned about are going around with hatred of Jewish people in their hearts.
No, but for example, there's the new book by... There's a new book by Walt Mearsheimer that talks about, you know, the incredible power of the Israeli lobby, which doesn't talk about the power of the Saudi Arabian lobby or the National Rifle Association. I mean, obviously, yes, there are people, there are Americans that come together that try to influence the country, you know, the political leaders to be more pro-Israel. There are Americans that come together to try to influence the country to be more pro-life or pro-choice or pro-guns or anything else. But it seemed that the argument that Mearsheimer was making was that somehow the Jewish control was more severe, the more fierce, worse than any other Americans banding together to lobby their government. And that's where I wonder if it relates back to the protocols, the Elders of Zion, or all these sort of anti-Jewish conspiracies.
It's really complicated, and I can't see into his heart. I haven't read the book, but I read the paper that he and a guy named Walt did together, and I was, when it was originally released, I thought, oh, wow, this is going to seriously challenge what I've been putting out because these guys are scholars. And the basic logic was, I swear to you, this is the basic logic of that paper. The U.S. war in Iraq does not appear to advance any legitimate U.S. military or defense, you know, sort of interest. Therefore, they must be doing it at the behest of Israel. And there's just not a lot of steps in between those two points. There's no alternate view of, there's about a half a sentence about the influence, for example, of oil. And they dismiss that. I think it's less than a sentence, actually, if I remember. So that's the logic. Now, why is he putting out that really shoddy logic to explain the influence of the Israeli lobby? Well, I have some theories.
Before I get to your theories, I just want to get something else on the record. It is true that neoconservatives approached Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Likud leader, not when he was in power, in the 90s, and suggested invading Iraq, to which Netanyahu told them, please don't. It really won't be good for Israel. If you're asking me as an Israeli leader whether we want you to do this, we don't. It'll just make our enemies very, very mad. So they actually did approach Israel. That much is true, saying, do you want us to do this? Israel told them, no, we don't. Thanks very much. A lot of people may not be aware of that meeting.
The story is we're supposed to believe is that Israel has some sort of special hold over the U.S. The only way I could think they could have such a hold, of course, is a network of American Jews. I mean, how else do you explain this phenomenal power they must have? I don't know how else. I've never seen a good explanation of that that didn't.
I should quote my own congressman. My congressman, Jim Moran, who is a congressman of Northern Virginia, said that we would not be in Iraq if it weren't for the drumbeat of American Jews, which is very interesting. First of all, it happens to be false. American Jews actually, if you look at the polls, supported the war in Iraq in the same numbers as non-Jews. You know, whatever, it was 60-40 or 70-30. It was the same numbers. There were some that were for and some that were against, the same numbers as ordinary Americans. But this idea of sort of a Jewish world conspiracy working behind the scenes to control the earth, I mean, this is a very old mantra. I mean, this goes back before the Nazis, before the Soviets. This goes back thousands of years.
It's hard to make people see that because as you engage in that dialogue, then they retreat behind, well, it's not okay to criticize Israel. And then you say, well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying Israel does not run the U.S.
And, when is it okay to criticize Israel specifically? What's fair game and what's not fair game in your view?
I can't imagine why it wouldn't be okay to criticize Israel. What we're talking about just at this moment is not criticism of Israel. It's the theory that Israel is controlling the U.S., which is not the same as criticizing Israel. It's suggesting that this tiny country in the Middle East has somehow, I guess the way the right thinks of it, and some on the left actually, is that they have infiltrated, and the word I've seen is hijacked, the U.S. government. The U.S. government normally would be engaging only in beneficial acts for the world if it had not gotten hijacked by this group of Israeli loyalists. That's the theory. And a lot of people, more than I would like to admit on my side, the left, buy into this, at least in parts. And, of course, it has its genesis on the right. It's a very old theory, and as you say, it precedes Israel. Only now there's a specific place that they could focus on.
Let me talk about some of your work on your blog dealing with the Methodist Church. The Methodist Church has a proposal to divest from companies doing business with the Israeli military. Is that right?
Yeah. It's now the United Methodist Church is somewhat decentralized. There are various proposals, resolutions that are coming up before their national meeting that's coming up in a few months. But the general idea is that for 2 or 3 years now, they have been researching, and a fairly vocal group has been suggesting divestment from Israel and resolutions of various forms. The one that specifically made the news most recently is let's divest from Caterpillar, because Caterpillar sells tractors to Israel that are used for home demolitions. But they have, if you look, they have a more extensive history of looking at this issue. There's a list of 20 companies that a committee out of the New England sort of section of the United Methodist Church had targeted for divestment because of their selling weapons or in other ways supporting, in their view, the occupation of Palestine. In addition, there's a report that is used, from what I can understand, in some of their adult Christian education courses by Rabbi Stephen Goldstein, not rabbi, he's not a rabbi, he's Jewish, Reverend Stephen Goldstein, who, and it's very, very anti-Israel, and it's sort of a background document on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it actually makes the argument, I haven't read it yet because we have to pay for it and order it, it's not available free online, I do plan to do that, I don't have it yet, but some of the quotes have been circulating, including that the original sin of Israel was the founding of Israel. That's the original sin.
So the original sin of Israel is its mere existence.
It's the creation of the state.
The question of Israeli policies, the original sin is Israel's existence. Jews
and the idea that has gained traction on the left, which has always had traction on the right, and certainly among the right in the Arab world, is that the Zionist project had very little to do with people wanting a homeland and the rush for the creation of that from World War II forward was not really, it didn't speed up because of World War II. It was really part of a longstanding plan, a Zionist plan, that was from the very beginning planning to kick out all the Arabs and take over all the land themselves. But that was always the goal. It was always genocidal. It was always about removing Arabs and taking everything. And that just, it so oversimplifies the history, and I believe, without having read it, but just some summaries I've seen, I believe Goldstein does some of the same things. For example, he quotes a David Ben-Gurion quote that says something to the extent of we will have to displace all of the Arabs. And that's one of the famous quotes you see that bounces around all over the Internet. I've personally researched a bunch of them. That was several words were taken out of the quote, including...
Yeah, I can't imagine David Ben-Gurion saying that. So
what he was saying was it should not be necessary. We should be able to live side by side.
Okay, but would have said.
Well, the words that gave it that context have been removed from that quote. And there's a whole list. There's a famous list of like 28 quotes that go around on the Internet. And, you know, I spent some time debunking some of them that I could online. Some of them I have to find the sources. But anyway, that's the sort of thing. It has gotten mainstream to the point, to get back to the Methodist Church, that I think people of goodwill look at this as just an important issue, and they start to accept this analysis. and it allows...
Well, let me ask you, Ty. I mean, what's wrong with the Methodist Church saying, we don't agree with Israel's policy, so we want to divest from Israel? What's wrong with that?
That's a good question. And it's the heart of the question that I asked. I've been having a dialogue, and he's been wonderful, actually, because he's written some long emails to me, and he is pretty busy right now. He's hoping to get, I'm hoping maybe he'll come on your show. His name is William Aldrich, and he's one of the people that was involved in this committee. And I basically asked him that question.
Let me just say, for the record, I invite him to come on the show today, and he wasn't available, but I will invite him to come on the air in the future because I want him to have his say. I just want to make that clear to everybody. Go ahead,
Ty. It's important because I believe that so often the Methodist Church is on the right side of issues. I believe that most Methodist churches, they don't have a central policy that says if you're in the Methodist Church, you must believe this about this political issue, but a lot of them are anti-Iraq war, for example. The first thing he said, which I always hear, is it's not anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, and that's what you just said is perfectly okay, and that's never been my contention with the United Methodist Church. That's not the problem. The problem is, why are they focusing on Israel specifically? What is it about Israel that they feel like they need to divest? Well, the point of view is, there are a lot of things that Israel is doing that are directed because of U.S. support, and also the support of some of these companies they've targeted for divestment. My argument with them is, and this is specifically an argument that should find resonance, I hope, with people who are in some of these mainstream Protestant churches like the Methodist Church. What are your values that you're drawing on? And they have a social responsibility set of values that says we should not profit from, well, it doesn't say people who make weapons of war, actually. It says people who make weapons of war that are not for legitimate military purposes. Because one of the first things I noticed is here they are talking about divesting from Caterpillar that makes tractors, some of which have been used for these home demolitions, and yet they're still invested and not discussing Halliburton. And
so the Methodist Church invests... Hold on, let me just make this clear. The investment, the Methodist Church continues to invest in Halliburton?
They have their pension fund. Yeah, if you go to my website, you can find a link to an Excel file of the pension fund investments as of, I don't know which quarter, in 2007. It's the most recent I can find. Halliburton's on there. DynCorp is on there.
Tell us what DynCorp's done. I think the people who are listening know what Halliburton's done. Tell us what DynCorp has done.
Well, they sort of contract out as sort of like it's part of this outsourcing of legitimate military duties, that is to say, duties the military would normally do. They act sort of like police squads for the military all over the place. I think they've done it for the UN as well. They're fairly corrupt and actually got nailed for being involved in trafficking, including allegations that seem fairly legitimate, of even child trafficking, of prostitution, trafficking prostitutes, all this sorts of stuff. That came up in at least one congressional hearing, so this is fairly well known. But again, they make their money from moving into areas of war and contracting themselves out for labor. They're not making weapons, I'll grant you that. In addition, some of the things that the church did not find that they're still invested in are some of the big oil companies, for example, that I would argue have a lot to do with this war. And then there's other things that I think, they're invested in Walmart. That's not military, but if you're talking about social responsible investing, most people cross that off their list. They're invested in Chiquita, which is the old United Fruit, which continues to, in Central and South America, engage in very questionable tactics. Governments were overthrown in the 50s on their behalf, and recently they got nailed for paying off some Colombian paramilitaries so that they could have their plantations left alone. So my point
and you point out that they invest in Shell, where a Nigerian activist was tortured and executed for trying to talk about
the
environmental...
Shell, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and these things are painful to me. I don't really consider myself a Christian anymore. I guess a lot of it is politics. There was a time when I was fairly active on, I guess, what you could call the Christian left, if there is even such a thing anymore. But
there is Jim Wallace and people like that who
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And to have to even explain why investing in ExxonMobil is not socially responsible investing, I don't even know how to get into that, because how do you even make that argument? Why would you have to? Okay, so there's that. And then the other thing I looked at was their list of proposed divestment targets. And I assumed, now it's not completely centralized, so different churches or different sectors may be invested in different ways. But I assume if they were targeting Raytheon, for example, for divestment, that means that the United Methodist Church in some capacity must be already invested in Raytheon. How can they justify that? How can they justify other military contractors? One of them they've got with the United Technologies makes Black Hawks. Yes, they sell them to Israel, but they also sell them to the U.S. They also sell them to a variety of countries.
The Methodist Church invests in oil companies, in corporations that damage labor rights and the environment. They invest in weapons manufacturers that don't sell to Israel. How about companies doing business with Saudi Arabia or Iran or Sudan?
Let me give you just a couple quick examples. All right. Now, these are companies that are targeted by this one committee, and Mr. Aldrich is very careful to say, we were tasked with looking for companies that have investments in Israel. It was not our job to screen in general. The Methodist Church has a policy, and here it is. They gave me a copy. And the policy is they won't invest in weapons contractors that sell their weapons to private parties. But if the weapons are used for, quote, legitimate purposes, then it's okay. This is how you can explain the fact that they are invested in ATK. What do they make? Depleted uranium shells.
I'm sorry, what do they make?
Depleted uranium shells. Remember?
Depleted uranium shells. What's a depleted uranium shell?
It's a shell casing that a lot of our ammunition uses because it makes it easier to penetrate hard targets. But meanwhile, it's low-level radioactive, and it also usually creates a lot of sort of radioactive and toxic dust. And there's a lot of studies that are saying that in Iraq right now, there's thousands and thousands of tons of this stuff and an increase in birth defects and cancer because of it. And also maybe some connection to Gulf War syndrome. In other words, some of our own soldiers may be getting sick from this stuff. A lot of serious talk about banning depleted uranium weapons, like there's talk about banning landmines. This is a company that the Methodist Church is thinking of divesting from. Yay, I'm glad. But they leave the impression that if it were not for rubber-coated bullets that this company sells to Israel, this company would be okay to keep the United Methodist portfolio. It's crazy.
So what is it in the Methodist Church? Explain this to me, and maybe I need to bring Mr. Aldrich on the show and ask him the question, but what is it about the Methodist Church that sees what Israel does is a higher order of evil, say, than what we're doing in Iraq, what Raytheon does, what's happening in Darfur with genocide, what's happening, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia, and, you know, I can name a number of countries, Liberia, where they have the child soldiers. What is it that makes them want to focus on Israel rather than all these other dangerous places around the globe? Egypt, for example, also gets $2 billion in American aid and is brutal to political dissidents. Do they focus on Egypt?
Yeah, I'm just looking now. Boeing makes F-15s. Egypt gets them. Saudi Arabia gets them. Kuwait, that bastion of democracy, gets them. That's one example.
How do they explain that to you? I mean, what do they say to you about why?
Well, Mr. Aldrich,
on a democracy that is, you know, being attacked and is trying to struggle to exist and may or may not be using the best strategies to do that, but after all, is having 40 missiles a day raining on its territory, so it's trying to do its best. Compared to a country like Egypt that is under threat from no one, is getting billions of dollars in U.S. aid, and at the same time is persecuting Egyptians. I mean, how do they address that inconsistency?
Oh, I wish I could tell you there was a secret Nazi plot to overthrow or to take over the United Methodist Church, but I'm afraid that as far as I can tell so far, this really may come from my end of the political spectrum. I think this may just have to do with the fact that on the left, this emphasis on Israel above almost every other international conflict that does not directly involve the U.S., in other words, the Methodist Church to a large extent, and of course the U.S. left is against the Iraq War. I think it has just filtered up. To the best of my knowledge so far, all I can see is the people who are behind this are just sort of people who come to, as an activist background, who are just buying into this, what I think is a very sort of poisoned well of analysis. And
let me give our listeners a chance to join in this discussion. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. You can also comment on the blog, and I'll read your comments on there. Just go to RadioInsideScoop.com if you have a comment, and I'll raise it to Ty. Ty, we also have a chat room at the Head-On Radio Network, and one of the listeners there says, you know, Egypt isn't in the news. Israel's in the news. Egypt isn't in the news, so that's why they're focusing on it. How about that?
Well, I'd like to think that the people who would be on a committee like this would not make that their method of choosing, which Darfur is an important issue to the Methodist Church, and Darfur actually doesn't get in the news particularly. So I don't.
Okay,
that,
so they are for stopping the genocide in Darfur. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and I'm not going to speak for them on it. I haven't looked at what they're saying about it, so I'm not even going to comment on it. But I do know that that's something else I see on their blog. And you know, if you go to the UNC website, various websites associated with them, you'll see, at least I will, someone on the left, all kinds of stuff to agree with. But I think that there's a couple things going on. One thing is, big weapons are big business. You have a less cynical view about U.S. support of Israel than I do. I happen to think that certain sectors of the U.S. see Israel, who is mandated to spend a lot of their money they get from the U.S. on weapons from U.S. weapons manufacturers. They can't really go shopping. I don't know if that's changed, but that was certainly the way.
No, it still is. No, the money we give Israel for weapons must be spent on American weapons. Israel can't just buy the best weapons. They have to buy from our companies. It's seen as a way not just to help Israel, but to help American weapons manufacturers. No question about it.
All right. And so I see certain sectors supporting this relationship, probably supporting that particularly financially lucrative arrangement, and so I would sometimes, in other words, what I think may be happening is that I think there's maybe a growing sector within our political establishment who may have decided that Israel's usefulness, not talking about moral issues or anything like that, but just usefulness, may be waning, because now we've got a military base in the Middle East that used to be called Iraq. And, of course, Saudi Arabia we have. And so there's less of a need for those who cynically were wanting to use a relationship with Israel for Cold War purposes and oil protection purposes. Those folks may be losing interest in Israel. And it may
well, and to be clear, I'd want to be very, very clear. It's certainly not anti-Semitic to argue that the United States should not give funds for the military in Israel. You could certainly make that argument, but if you made that argument but didn't in the same breath say, why are we giving $2 billion to Egypt, a country whose existence is not under threat, a country that, unlike Israel, is a dictatorship, a country that rounds up its political prisoners and puts them in jail and does torture, and you don't include Egypt in that question, if you only want to say, don't give money to Israel, but you don't mention Egypt, then I have to say, well, what is that if not anti-Semitism? I mean, because on every single ground of human rights or need for the weapons, Egypt is worse than Israel.
Well, and that's certainly not the only country. I mean, I think to some degree the argument is, well, they're giving money to Egypt because that was a way to keep peace and agreement involved.
Well, right, but I'm saying if you want to end – no, that's true. I'm saying if you want to end giving military aid to Israel – and you don't mention ending military aid to Egypt. No, there's certainly an argument you give military aid to Egypt because they made peace with Israel. I mean, I know that argument. The strange thing to me is you go to college campuses, you go to and you see this tremendous almost like I remember when I was in college, the discussion of South Africa. And I supported those things, the anti-apartheid rallies, and I certainly
was
part of those.
That's the model they're using, for sure.
And I was part of those rallies, and I see the same thing against Israel, and it always strikes me is if Israel's being attacked with 40 missiles a day that are going and shooting and killing children and so forth, what do they want Israel to do? When they say they want Israel to cease to exist, What does that mean for the people there that have no other place to go? I mean, it seems to me not a far cry from there to the gas chambers. I mean, if Israel ceases to exist, then...
Okay, here's the idea, and here's the paradox, and I can give you a little bit of history about, again, why the left has embraced this sort of belief system in ways that may not imply, like, if you look into the heart of an individual leftist, that he hates Jews. That's really not the point. We eliminate Israel and make it a secular democracy. But where are the secular democracies around it to ensure that it doesn't simply become another sort of Islamic state, and that all of the sort of decades of animosity that have built up are not going to, in fact, I'm not going to say gas chambers like you're saying, but I don't think it would be pretty.
There's not a single Hamas leader that wants to destroy the state of Israel so that it becomes a secular democracy where all people live in peace and freedom. I just don't hear Mahmoud Ahmadinejad saying Israel should become a secular place where all Jews and Arabs live in peace and freedom. I mean, it's just amazing to me that people could even think that. Maybe they just don't know the neighborhood that Israel is in. I mean, maybe they just don't understand why let me give you an example. Louis Farrakhan, who I mentioned him because it came up recently in the Obama-Clinton debate, and I was doing some research on whether Farrakhan had said anti-Semitic stuff lately, because there was some argument by some people that, oh, well, he used to be an anti-Semite, but he's toned it down. And I found that less than a year ago, he gave a speech, and I checked it out. I listened to the YouTube to hear it was actually his words and his language. It wasn't, you know, some fake thing. He said that the Jews that are in Israel are not really Jews. They are Europeans. They converted to Judaism. They're not really from the region. They came in as colonial imperialists and took over the land. And he's basically denying the existence of the Jewish people is what he's saying.
That's a fairly common right-wing sort of conspiracy theory. I'm familiar with that. I haven't heard it come from him, but I know.
But what's interesting is now
people got it from.
It's an old right-wing conspiracy theory, and now, I mean, Farrakhan, I don't think you call him right-wing. I mean, maybe it's unfair to the left.
The nation is fairly fascistic. Yeah, they're you know, it's odd to think of a fascist movement in the U.S. that would be made of a minority that would be targeted by most fascist movements in the United States, in the U.S. But he's got ties to LaRouche. He's even had some ties to the Klan, believe it or not.
Louis Farrakhan has ties to the Klan?
They've had some talk, you know, because they're nationalists. They want a sort of an African-American or African.
I guess they agree on a lot. They both agree that whites and blacks should be separated from each other and each have their own power, I guess. So maybe they do have a lot to agree on. I never thought of it that way.
Now, I want to hasten to point out Malcolm X is one of my heroes. And Malcolm X, in his early part of his career, that he preached the exact same thing. He actually went to Mecca and got a broader view of Islam, mainly because he saw a lot of non-black people were practicing Islam. And not long after that, he was killed by members of the Nation of Islam. I want to be clear, and I even understand nationalism and even separatism. I don't condemn a minority group, an oppressed minority group, saying we've had it, we're moving. You know, that's not. It's not. But anyway, he does have ties to a lot of these sort of the right wing network. But in any event, where it comes from on the left, I think. First of all, there's the old-fashioned Communist Party that was following the Russian line, and then when the Soviet Union got Stalin, Stalin evidently didn't much care for the Jews, because there were a lot of Jews who were involved in the revolution.
Well, one thing about Stalin, Ty, that you may know, is Stalin originally saw the Jews of Palestine, they're about to form the State of Israel. He saw they were very socialistic, and it is true. Israel probably has more socialism than virtually any country on earth, true democratic socialism with the kibbutzim and the, you know, real movements where you really do, you serve the good of the community. And so he thought that Israel would be a natural ally of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union indeed recognized Israel's right to exist in voting for the United Nations resolution of 1947, along with all of their, you know, the people they control, the countries, Poland, yeah, East Germany, and so forth. It's when Israel didn't turn out to be in the Soviet sphere of influence that Stalin got mad and then turned 180 degrees and became not only anti-Israel, but even started a plot to kill the Jews of the Soviet Union that thankfully he died before that plot happened.
Well, the politics get very weird, because what happens is you have someone like Nasser in Egypt that almost in the same breath goes from sort of embracing a sort of fascism, and then communist Soviet Union had relationships with him, and sometimes the U.S. did. So, and you know, even before Israel, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem had ties to the Nazi Party, and then even after he was no longer Grand Mufti, he was recruiting for the Nazi army. And
of course, he's Yasser Arafat's mentor. A lot of people don't realize that Arafat's mentor, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who met with Hitler in Berlin and said, "Hey, can you bring some of that good stuff down here to Palestine?" A lot of people don't realize that he was, you know, he trained Arafat.
It's fairly well documented. It's pretty easy to find. And the deal is that sometimes people who are in trouble don't get to choose their allies, but clearly, without restraining the Grand Mufti, this was an ideology he actually had before he approached Hitler because of that, and he had ties to the Italian fascists as well. And he really, there's even a quote on Wikipedia from his own memoirs where he's saying, "Our deal with the Germans was, if they won, we had free reign to dispose of the Jews in this area how we wanted to." So he really had that virulent, and it was not just a matter of embracing an ally that you just, you know, under political expediency. It was really consistent with his philosophy. And he gave birth to that sort of movement. There's a Muslim Brotherhood that comes out of that. Some of it had to do with just alliances to kick Britain out. Even some of the Ergun folks were tentatively looking at allying with Hitler before he was clear.
Well, not allying with Hitler, they were fighting the British. The thing is that there were Arab leaders that were very supportive of a Jewish state. King Faisal comes to mind, who signed an agreement with Chaim Weizmann at the turn of the century, because at that time all the Arab and Jewish lands were occupied. Judea was occupied and Arabia was occupied, and they agreed to divide it up. And, you know, the great, great majority of the lands would be Arab lands. And, in fact, Faisal agreed to give Israel what is today Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, and the Golan Heights, which would be, you know, extreme. But that's what, you know, Faisal agreed to, because it's obviously less than 1% of all the lands that the Arabs would get. And they would actually work together against the British. But I guess my question at the end of the day, I think it may relate back to Farrakhan, is, you know, the Ottoman Empire occupied Judea and Arabia and Greece and Romania and Bulgaria and a whole host of countries. And when it fell apart, no one seems to complain that Bulgaria had a state and Romania had a state and that, you know, Syria had a state. It seems that the only people on earth that aren't allowed to have a state is the Jews. And that's the thing I wonder where, I guess, anti-Semitism comes in. Not disagreeing with Israeli policy, one or the other, but actually arguing that there should be no Jewish state.
So what we're looking at is examining a double standard. That's why I was interested in the Methodist Church. Are they really applying their principles across the board, or have they bought into this? And I guess I wonder, because I sort of got away from it. I'll try to do this very briefly. Where did this come from in the left? We talked about Stalin. Eventually, I think a lot of the communist left in the U.S. became disillusioned with Stalin, but there was that influence. The second is some of the ways that the Jews came to Israel was based on a colonial model, because colonialism was not really seen as an evil by the – it was just part of the way – you know, I mean, they came – you know, especially folks that came out of Britain. I mean, so there was a colonialist aspect to some of it, and so the left wanting to be anti-imperialist is going to oppose that. And the third thing, I think, is that the left sort of took to embracing any nationalist group that opposed the West under the idea that, well, if they're nationalist in a sort of developing country or third world country, they probably have some moral legitimacy because they're opposing the Western practices that are keeping them down. But that led to this sort of uncritical acceptance of just about any nationalist group that came along, including, you know, Hamas, Hezbollah, all those sorts of folks. And that created a sort of ripe ground where some movements that really are on the right could sort of make some ideological headway. And you see a little bit in the U.S., but in places like Russia particularly, you see the left and right actually creating these sorts of alliances. I call them a red-brown alliance, the color red for the left and the brown for the right. And so you actually see this nationalism, which is we are not going to let other countries tell us what to do, which that's legit, hooked up with a sort of anti-Semitism, and you get an influence that is far beyond the far right where it emerged from. And unfortunately, it has percolated up so that I think really well-meaning folks on the left, and I'm going to assume the folks in the UNC who were behind this were just folks who may have been doing South Africa divestment stuff 20 years ago, have bought into it uncritically. Let's look at Hamas. Let's look at Hezbollah. What's their history? What are they actually saying they want to do? And why are you suggesting that they are legitimate in what they're trying to do? And that's the part that really worries me.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did a show a few days ago, and I was doing a show on Gaza and asking people what they think Israel should do in response to the missiles. And a woman called in. She had a Arabic-sounding name from Northern Virginia. And she said, well, you know, Gaza's under occupation. And I said, well, no, Gaza is currently not under Israeli occupation. There's not a single Israeli soldier there. And she said, yes, it is under occupation, and the Israelis are committing genocide. And I said, no, they're not. There's, you know, yes, Israel's responding to missiles by shooting back, but genocide has a real meaning. And, for people to throw the word genocide around, genocide is when you take, you know, every man, woman, and child of a certain group, ethnic group, racial group, religious group, and you seek to exterminate them. You seek to wipe their existence off the planet. Genocide does occur. I think it's occurring in Darfur right now. I think it occurred in Rwanda. I think, you know, to some extent it occurred in Kosovo, where you find, you know, literally going in and trying to kill everybody. But people throw these terms around, and suddenly, I don't know, I guess you say something enough, and people start to believe it. You know, why can't, I mean, the Methodist Church, I mean, for example, Barack Obama, and he's certainly no one on the right, wrote a very strong letter to the United Nations Security Council saying that before you condemn Israel, recognize that they are being bombarded with missiles every single day, and they have an absolute right under the UN Charter to defend themselves. So, you know, don't condemn Israel. And but, you know, Barack Obama in that way has a very, I guess, mainstream American view, and yet he's considered to be from the left. What is it about the left that romanticizes a Hamas or a Hezbollah? I guess I don't get it. Do they see them in the same light as they would see, a fighting South African oppression?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of folks who are embracing this are getting, first of all, I think there really are right-wing networks that are fairly good at getting their word out, and they also are fairly good at adapting their language to fit the context. You can see the extreme right, like Stormfront, which I think got pulled, but they have a discussion board, and I was on another discussion board and saw a guy who had a name that was clearly a name that would alarm me, and I went over to Stormfront and found that they really have directions from, actually, the post I found from David Duke himself, which was explaining when you go to these places, don't immediately start going talk about Jews. Engage them in discussions that they're engaged in and slowly introduce the topic. So there is a sort of concerted effort to push this out there. And when you have people like Ray McGovern...
This is interesting to me. Hold on. So David Duke is sending, Klansmen or whoever...
Himself. He posted at Stormfront saying this would be a great idea. I'm not going to say they were working directly with him.
But basically, he's suggesting that Klansmen go to, I guess, left-wing rallies and persuade people to hate you.
Well, he was talking about online in this particular context. Visit places online and slowly introduce, you know, really saying things like use terms like Zionist, don't use terms like Jews. So there's that, and he's still kind of a marginal figure. I'm not that scared of David Duke himself. But then you have people like Ray McGovern, who's putting out the general, he was quoting, it's all about Israel. Israel is the reason we're doing this. Well, the CIA knows a bit about putting out disinformation. So there are these networks out there. There's another one that I'm looking into that I'm not going to talk about right now, but it's absolutely fascinating because they're primarily online and they put this sort of material out. And then you have legitimate people on the left who, you know, would look at the ANC as fighting oppression, and they have bought into this. And so, again, they themselves do not have hatred of Jews in their heart, but they have allowed the debate to be defined for them. They have allowed the terms of debate to be so narrowed that this has crept up, which is why it was such a disaster for the anti-war movement. For example, you had Cindy Sheehan accused of, she denied it, but let's just assume for a minute that she really said it, my son died for Israel. Now, she denied saying that, but I know some of the people who are around her at her peace camp, and some of those folks would be the exact type to be telling her, giving her that perspective, and I don't know what her political background, how sophisticated she was before this. And that's a disaster for the anti-war movement when that sort of thing happens.
Cindy Sheehan is a hero of the anti-war movement.
She did deny saying that, and let's just give her the benefit of the doubt, but you see how putting that out there was harmful.
It harms everybody. It harms the people who are against the war in Iraq. It harms people who believe in Cindy Sheehan, and it makes her seem also nutty and crazy.
And we're not talking about Saudi Arabia, and we're not talking about oil. And the main group that was lodging having the rallies, you know, the answer under Ramsey Clark. Ramsey Clark was the defense attorney for Linda LaRouche and has spoken at LaRouche events. He did more than just be his defense attorney. The LaRouche organization is very sophisticated about putting out their right-wing conspiracy theory in ways that can be acceptable to different audiences. That's Ramsey Clark. That was the main anti-war group in the United States. So that's where it's complicated, but you see how there's the right wing that's sort of infiltrating, then there's well-meaning leftists who say, oh, I'm anti-imperialist, I'm anti-colonialist, I'm pro-nationalist, and so I'm going to look at this issue from that perspective, and yet the ground kind of gets contaminated. And I guess I would just say, because I know we're running out of time, to the Methodist Church.
Yeah, we have to wrap up. We can find out more about this on your website at dreamsend.com, right?
Dreamsendweb.com, all one word. Dreamsendweb.com.
Dreamsendweb.com. And let me just say that this is a discussion that can go on, obviously, for hours more, and we'll have to do that. Ty Brown, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
I was very glad to.
That's a wrap, folks. We will see you next week right here on the Inside Scoop. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
Wonderful, wonderful show, Mark. Thanks.